let's get at what we're really here for, and that's to hear Richard. And tonight, it is the Richard Miller story, the beginning and the continuation of his involvement from the year 1954 through the present time. Richard, if you will, please.
Microphone sounds a little bit like Inner Sanctum. Don't any of you remember that radio program many years ago? Thank you, Maynard. That gentleman just speaking to you was Maynard Eaves, a very good friend of ours, as you can tell. For those of you who don't know, I'm Richard Miller. This evening, as Maynard mentioned, we're going to be talking about how I got involved in this entire picture. I might mention that this is a very, very difficult talk for me to give. It's difficult in this way, in that I've probably only given it once or twice in some 20-odd years. Therefore, we'll please ask your indulgence if we maybe skip a few items, but I promise you, if you have questions, we'll try and go back and fill in any gaps that we might inadvertently leave out. It's also difficult because it has caused some pain in my life back in the early 50s in terms of public embarrassment, being called a kook, a nut, a liar, a charlatan, etc. These type things can sometimes get to you, particularly when, as we were in those days, kind of fat, dumb, and happy, or maybe just plain naive. A marvelous thing had occurred to us, and naturally, like most people, we wanted to get out and tell the world about it. The only thing was that in the 1950s, there weren't very many in the world who wanted to listen to it. So consequently, this story has not been told very often. I think we'll start out by saying, ladies and gentlemen, that in the year 1948, I was pretty much of a skeptic on the whole subject of UFOs and flying saucers. I had heard some comments regarding flying saucers. This isn't loud enough. Is that better? It's on. Maybe I should just try and talk louder. In any event, we had heard all kinds of stories about UFOs, and like most people, we thought people were having hallucinations. At that particular time, I was in the United States Air Force. Of course, I should say, at that time, I was in the Army Air Corps, because it was during 1947 and 48 that the name of the organization was changed to the United States Air Force. And we gave up our olive drab Eisenhower jackets and trousers and so forth, and we went to what they call Air Force Blue. The only problem is the Air Force Blues didn't come in for a few years. All of us waited. On January, the 7th, 1948, I happened to be in the operations room at Scott Air Force Base in Belleville, Illinois. Now, in the military, we had what was called an air defense sector. And this particular air base on which I was part of a military defense sector, or an air defense sector, the same one that involves Fort Knox in Kentucky. And on this particular day, a UFO had appeared in the Fort Knox area. Now, that's restricted airspace. In other words, private aircraft and military aircraft do not fly over Fort Knox. Therefore, an unidentified flying object over Fort Knox created quite a stir. All of the air bases in the area were alerted. I happened to be, as I said, in the operations room when the alert came through. A most amazing thing happened. All of the various air bases in the sector were tied together on a common communications link so that all of us could hear what was going on. And the action was taking place at Godman Air Force Base in Kentucky. There, the tower operators suddenly viewed a UFO flying in the near vicinity of Godman Air Force Base. It was observed first with binoculars by the tower control personnel. They immediately alerted the base commander at Godman and called him to come to base headquarters. The alert went out to all the air bases in the sector because at that time we did not have very many jet interceptors around, but we did have the fastest thing in the Air Force at that time that was commonly available, the F-51 fighter, which was a propeller-driven aircraft, for those of you who can remember those days. All right, about that same time, a squadron of four F-51s was flying near Godman Air Force Base. They were called on the radio by the tower operator and asked to pursue this object and attempt to identify it. They did. They changed course and went after an unidentified flying object. Now, I should mention that one of the reasons pursuit was engaged in this instance was the fact that we had lost, speaking of the Air Force, two officers in a previous encounter with UFOs earlier in the year up in Tacoma, Washington. And since two Air Force officers had died in the investigation concerning a UFO, we were a little bit uptight, or the Air Force was, about this subject. So we immediately had these four propeller-driven fighters take off to start chasing this UFO. The gentleman, the pilot, in charge of the flight was a Captain Thomas Mantell. And we started listening to the radio traffic between Godman Air Force Tower and Captain Mantell and the three other aircraft that were with him. And they chased this object for quite a considerable period of time. Our first alert occurred at 1:50 in the afternoon, and at 2:30, Captain Mantell's flight was alerted to start the pursuit. Well, we have an account here of what took place at that time. I don't think we'll go into all of it, other than to say that Captain Mantell's flight was running low on fuel. And so his three wingmen, who were with him that day, all asked permission at various stages of the pursuit to come back to Godman or to Staniford Field in Kentucky for both refueling as well as taking on oxygen equipment. None of these planes were equipped with oxygen, as this was a routine flight that they were on, a low-level flight. Captain Mantell is the only person who did not report back to the base for refueling or for oxygen. I would like to just quote his part of the conversation with the tower. We have the complete conversation here between the tower and him, but let's just talk about his remarks. After he was directed to pursue it, he said, quote, "I see it, it's above and ahead of me, and I'm still climbing." One of his wingmen, who was still with him at that time, asked him, "What the hell are we looking for?" He hadn't seen the object. And Mantell answered him and said, "The object is directly ahead and above me," directing the other pilot's attention to where it was. That was at 2:45. At 3:05 that afternoon, Mantell again called in on his radio, and he said the following, "I've sighted this thing. It's metallic. It's tremendous in size. and it's starting to climb higher. Now at this time, both the object and Mantell and one fighter plane that was still with him were in visual view of the tower through binoculars. At 3:10 in the afternoon, 5 minutes later, Mantell again called in, and he said, "It's climbing still higher. It's 12 o'clock high. It's making half my speed. I'll try and close in." That time, the remaining pilot with him, Lieutenant Hammond, called him and said, "Level off, Captain, until I regain visual contact." Mantell's airplane was climbing so rapidly that even his wingman was having a hard time keeping up with him and had lost sight of him. His wingman then reported that he had lost sight of Mantell. Now at 3:15, just a few minutes later, Mantell called in still again. And he said, "It's still above me, making my speed or better. I'm going up to 20,000 feet. If I'm no closer, I'll abandon the chase." That is where the official account ends. I should say the official Air Force account. There was one further radio transmission from Mantell at 3:18 that afternoon. His last statement has been stricken from all of the records. Quote, "My God, I see people in this thing," unquote. That was his last comment. After that, the tower lost sight of Mantell. They lost sight of the object. They called Mantell repeatedly on the radio, and he didn't answer. At 5:50 that evening, some 2 hours later, Godman Tower received a telephone call from Stanford Air Force Base that they had a phone report from a farmer down in Franklin, Kentucky, that a plane with a certain serial number, NG3869, had crashed on this man's farm. The crash had occurred at 4:45 in the afternoon. At that time, the alert was canceled to all of the air bases. The object had disappeared. Mantell had crashed. Captain Mantell was dead. The next morning, there was a briefing on what was now the Mantell case. And we won't go into all of the details other than to say that Captain Mantell's plane had flown for 1 hour and 20 minutes beyond his available fuel supply. No one could account for that. Captain Mantell met his death as a result of exceeding 12,000 feet without oxygen. He had blacked out, lost control of the airplane, and crashed. The only problem was, if he was blacked out and unconscious, which would have occurred approximately at 3:25 in the afternoon, how did his airplane continue to fly for an hour and 25 minutes with an unconscious pilot at the controls and with no fuel in the tanks? Another mysterious happening in the Mantell case, which raised tremendous questions. An aircraft falling from that height out of control would normally go into a spin condition. Now, this was a stick-controlled airplane. All of you have seen pictures of the old planes where the pilot had this control stick between his knees. Mantell's plane was the same way. Had he been unconscious, he would have let loose of the stick, and his feet would have relaxed on the rudder pedals of the aircraft. The plane would have gone into a spin, particularly an F-51. Has anyone here ever flown an F-51? All right. That being the case, when the airplane hit the ground in a spinning condition, it should have bored a hole into the ground some 15 to 20 feet deep. Mantell's plane hit the ground perfectly flat, and the earth underneath the aircraft was only compressed 2 inches. We found that kind of hard to believe, with one exception, the eyewitness report of the farmer on whose farm the plane crashed. He saw the plane coming down in a spin, but he then made a statement that just literally blew everybody's mind. He said as the airplane reached treetop level, it was enveloped in a brilliant white flash of light. This light was so bright it was like looking at the sun. The airplane appeared to fall out of this brilliant white light and pancake into the ground. Now, whatever this brilliant white light was, it brought the airplane out of a spin, and it slowed the rate of descent. Because of this reason, falling from that height again, the wreckage of the airplane would have been scattered over a wide area on impact. All that happened to Mantell's plane was that the fuselage, the tail assembly, the rear empennage broke loose, and the wings broke off on impact. The tail assembly was less than a foot away from the rest of the airplane. The wings were only inches away from the fuselage. If it hadn't have been for the farmer's eyewitness report, it would have looked as if a giant crane had picked his airplane up and dropped it in a flat position. It would have done the same type of damage. Some mysterious force had somehow interfered with the crash of his airplane. Captain Mantell died because when the plane hit the ground with that violent an impact of dropping from approximately 40 feet up in the air, which was treetop height, the impact was so great that it broke his shoulder restraining straps. He flew forward over the control stick. The control stick impaled him through the chest, and that's how Captain Mantell died. The airplane, contrary to many stories, was not radioactive. There was no unusual magnetic phenomena about the aircraft. No parts were mysteriously magnetized, contrary to some writers. The aircraft had functioned perfectly. It had experienced no malfunctions of any kind. All electrical and mechanical systems were checked out at the crash site. The aircraft was in perfect flying condition. But the fuel tanks were dry, and there was no spillage of any fuel on the ground at the crash site. Again, verifying the fact the tanks were dry. Quite an investigation took place all that evening, and the next morning, this briefing took place in which all of these factors that I'm bringing out to you were brought out. That looked like the end of it. A report as a result of this briefing was forwarded to the Air Force Intelligence Command at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. With the conclusion that Captain Mantell had met his death pursuing an intelligently controlled unidentified flying object. We couldn't explain anything else. The next day was a Wednesday. That evening, our base had been alerted via teletype that there was going to be a special briefing, this time not in the operations room, but at base headquarters. Anyone and everyone who had been connected with the Mantell case were to report at 0900 hours. All of the documents, the logs, the wire recordings of the radio traffic, were to be brought to this meeting. So at 0900, we were all at base headquarters. A meeting was then conducted by an officer from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base of the Air Technical Intelligence Command. He requested, first of all, that Wright-Patterson wanted all of the information we had, including all of the wire recordings, so that ATIC could make a further investigation. So, very dutifully, all the records were turned over to this officer. Then the officer said, "We have made an investigation, and I would like to read you the information that was going to be released later that day by ATIC to the press, because the press was really hot on everybody to get an explanation of what in the world happened to Mantell. We were told that in order to present a completely unbiased and objective report, that ATIC had called in a civilian consulting scientist who was at that time working for the Air Force. This scientist was Dr. J. Allen Hynek from Northwestern University. And this is what we were told. Dr. Hynek had read all of the information that had come in from the crash team, the survey report, and he had come up with a conclusion. Quote, Dr. Hynek's conclusion. Captain Mantell mistakenly thought he was pursuing an unidentified flying object. In reality, he was either chasing the reflection of the planet Venus on the canopy of his aircraft, or he was chasing the planet Venus, which was visible low on the horizon on the afternoon of this incident. Mantell could not possibly have been chasing a UFO, nor was there any UFO involved in this incident," unquote. We were then told that Air Technical Intelligence Command concurred with Dr. Hynek's findings, and we were then told to forget all of the foolishness about a UFO. We were additionally ordered not to discuss the case with civilians or with the press. It was strictly a military matter. A lot of us raised a beef at that. It smelled fishy. First of all, they had asked for all the evidence in our possession to conduct further investigation. After we had turned it over to them, they said they'd already completed the investigation. What can we say? Except that several years later, Dr. Hynek admitted publicly that the Air Force had pressured him into writing that particular report. Ladies and gentlemen, I was no longer a skeptic. I had been up till that time. Now I wondered why we had gone to all of the trouble to cover it up, to keep it away from the press and from the public. I therefore finished my tour of duty in the Air Force, and as most people, that glad day arrived when I was released from the Air Force. We got discharged. And so I went happily back to civilian life, and an interesting thing happened. I'd been out of the service maybe 6-7 months. I was still trying to figure out what I wanted to do in civilian life. I had thoughts of going into the television repair business with a friend of mine. TV was just kind of getting off the ground in those days, and we thought it might be a good business to go into. And then in January of 1949, I received a phone call from Air Technical Intelligence Command, asking whether or not I would be interested in becoming an undercover civilian investigator of UFOs. Naturally, I thought, gee, this is a good way to get some information, the real scoop. If nothing else, I'll satisfy my own curiosity on this subject. So I asked, what would be involved? And why in the world did they need a civilian to go out and check them up? They had enough intelligence officers that could go check out all the reports. And they explained that the public was refusing to talk to Air Force intelligence officers. And I said, well, that doesn't surprise me. Every time you go out and talk to them, you make them feel like they're idiots. You know, you give them the idiot treatment. And they said, yes, that's what's happened. Now every time an officer shows up in uniform, they won't talk to us. So they said, we need somebody out of uniform to talk to these people who can just go up and say, hey, I'm interested. Tell me what you saw, what you experienced. And he said, there's some people around who claim that they're having contact with UFOs, and we'd like to know more about these fellows and what the contacts are. But they will not talk to us, so we need civilian investigators. Well, I worked for ATIC up until July of 52 in that capacity. It was part-time. They didn't need me all the time. So I went ahead and I had another job. But every time they needed someone to go out and check into a story, and there were others like me, and there was nobody else available, they'd give me a call and I'd go out. And Uncle Sam always picked up the tab for all the expenses plus $30 a day in wages. Alrighty. All this time, many, many things went on in the Air Force. But 1952, I left that investigative capacity. Again, this time I became a full-fledged civilian. But I was still interested in UFOs because now I knew there was really something to them. I had investigated a number of cases. I had read file reports. Project Blue Book had come into existence by that time, but I had worked through two previous projects that very few people knew about. One called Project Sign, one called Project Grudge, and finally Project Blue Book. An interesting thing happened. For 2 years, I was a television repairman. I had a partner. We owned our own private business. One day I read in the newspaper that there was a fellow coming to our hometown who claimed to have been in radio communications with UFOs. We thought that was pretty good. I had been very much interested in radio, had been a ham radio operator. A lot of my friends were ham radio operators, and we thought, hey, somebody claims they've talked to UFOs via shortwave radio. This was in Detroit, Michigan. This fellow, by the name of George Hunt Williamson, came to Detroit to deliver a talk on communicating with space intelligences via shortwave radio. He told a story about how he and a fellow who was a telegrapher for the Santa Fe Railroad in Winslow, Arizona, and who was also a ham radio operator, had gotten in touch with UFOs using this fellow's ham radio rig. They had transmitted back and forth in international Morse code and had gotten intelligent replies. Well, we all went to hear this fellow Williamson talk about this. And after the lecture was over, we went up to him and introduced ourselves and said we were very interested. Could he please tell us what frequencies they had used? So he gave us a list of the frequencies that this ham radio operator and he had used back in Arizona. And we said, well, we will listen for some type of communication on these frequencies. And he said, if you do hear anything, would you let me know? And I said, you'll be the first to know. Just let us know how we can reach you. So he gave us his itinerary. He was on a lecture tour, so that if anything did occur, we could communicate with him. There were about six of us in the group that had gone to hear him that night, and so we set up our shortwave equipment. We had some in our homes, we had some in our cars, and we had some in our office, in our television shop. We, of course, since we couldn't monitor all the time or listen all the time, we rigged up a tape recorder to the receiver so that it would turn on and off automatically if anything came in. And we monitored three or four different frequencies. Well, 2 months went by, and we didn't hear anything but a bunch of static. Didn't hear a peep out of our shortwave radios. And we were just about ready to call it all quits and say it was a bum try. And then one evening, on the 20th of September in the year 1954, or the 10th of September, I should say, a radio message was received. Now, this being the first radio message we had ever received, we didn't know who it was from. But the message came in voice, it was in English, and an extremely powerful signal. There was an odd choice of words used in the message. The inflection of the voice was strange. We listened to the message. We had made a tape recording of it. And we went over it and over it and over it afterwards. Our first thought was, some of our buddies are pulling our leg. As most ham radio operators are kind of a gabby bunch of guys anyway. And we weren't any exceptions to this. We had talked about the fact that we were listening for UFOs, and of course, our friends, our other ham radio operator buddies, would kid us a lot about it. Say, have you had anything from space lately, you know, and this type of thing. So the first thing we thought is one of our friends had pulled a stunt on us, and he'd sent us this shortwave message, and thought there was going to be a good laugh about this, you know, the next time we saw him. So we really didn't pay too much attention to this first message because we thought it was a joke. Someone was playing on us. The only thing is, at the end of the message, there was a schedule involved, and they said that on 5 days later, on the 15th of September, there'd be another one, another radio message. And they gave us the frequency to listen to. Well, we thought, all right, we'll go along with this. We'll see what happens. Sure enough, right at the time they specified, here comes another radio message. But this time we were ready for them. All of you know what a sports car rally is? Okay. Ham radio operators also play games. Only we used to have what we called hidden transmitter hunts. We'd send some guy with a portable shortwave set out into the boondocks, and he would send a message. And we had all built up radio direction finding equipment. And we were having a lot of fun. We'd all get out there and we'd take bearings on this fellow's signal and we'd triangulate his position on the map and we'd go nailing. You know, it was just like playing fox and hounds or having great fun at a sports car rally. So on this second message, we were all set up, six of us, with direction-finding equipment in six different automobiles. And we thought, boy, if there's anybody out there playing games with us, we're going to get him. Well, the message came, the message went, and we drew a blank. We couldn't get a bearing on the signal. Now, we knew it wasn't the equipment malfunctioning, because six sets of equipment couldn't all malfunction at the same time. But we couldn't get a bearing, period. No matter which way we turned our direction-finding equipment, the signal was equally as strong. So we were up in the air. This threw us for a loss. With the second message came a schedule for a third message. We thought maybe we weren't doing something right. We'd better get the pros involved. So we called up the local Federal Communications Commission office in Detroit, and we said, hey, fellas, we're having some trouble with what we think's an illegal station.
Come on out and help us try and track it down. Well, the FCC likes to do that kind of thing. So they sent out their nice little monitoring trucks with the rotating loop antennas on the top. And away we went on the third night of the message. Or the third message, again at night. And they didn't have any better luck than we did. We drew a blank again. The only thing is, one of the guys had brushed up against a tree and had knocked the antenna loose from the side of his car. It was on a little bracket out from the vent wing window. And so in trying to fix it up, as the message was coming in, it was laying over on its side. Instead of looking in a horizontal plane, it was looking up, the antenna was. And he got a bearing. He noticed the signal was coming from straight up. He called us on his radio. And he said, take your mounts loose and turn them up. Lay them on their side. We did. We all got a bearing straight up. The only thing is the FCC couldn't do that without turning their whole truck over. They couldn't detach theirs. So, but we could. We didn't have as neat equipment as they did. So in any event, we got a bearing straight up. Well, then we got to thinking, well, now look. This is the third or fourth time we've received the message via shortwave radio. We now get a bearing straight up. We can't get a bearing as it being any ground-based station. If any of our buddies are up there renting an airplane, flying around, sending us these phony messages, it's sure costing somebody a bundle to pull our leg. So we begin to give a little more credence to this whole thing. Because we just couldn't figure out, you know, once or twice, sure, we could understand. But it gets awfully expensive to rent airplanes. Even back then. So we couldn't figure anybody who was that well-heeled. All ham radio operators that we knew of were dead broke most of the time. And we didn't figure any of them had enough money to hire a plane. So we gave up on that idea. About that time, on the 20th of September, we went out to our office mailbox one morning, and in there was an envelope. The envelope was addressed to our company. There was no return address on the envelope, and there wasn't any postage stamp on the envelope. But the envelope had been canceled at the post office. Well, we thought maybe the stamp had fallen off. Somebody hadn't glued it on right. We opened the envelope up, and here is a set of plans written on ordinary notebook paper, plain white paper. We later found out she could have bought it in any one of 100 stores. And here was a set of electronic drawings. Well, we looked at these drawings, and at first we couldn't make heads or tails out of them until we figured out that it was some type of a photoelectric eye coupled to an audio amplifier. In other words, it was some kind of an instrument designed to receive a beam of light, just like an electric eye in a supermarket. You know, if you walk through and it opens the door for you automatically. Well, we got to thinking and we said, wait a minute. Where do you use light beam applications for sound? And, of course, the first thing we thought of was a motion picture projector. That's how you get the sound off the soundtrack. So we went ahead. And we decided we'd build this thing up because down in one corner of the last page, there were three pages of drawings, there was a name. And the name was MECK-TAU. And we thought, that's a weird name. But it's interesting. We went ahead and decided it only cost us maybe $20 to build this thing. So we went ahead and built it. And we made a light beam receiver. We didn't know why we were building it, but we thought somebody went to all the trouble to send us the plans. Okay, we received a number of radio communications thereafter, and about three messages later, our friends from outer space, whom we were beginning to think of them as by that time, commented on the plans they had sent us. Well, now we knew at least who they came from. They asked us to continue building it, and they said to us that on October the 17th of 1954, Mr. George Hunk Williamson will be returning to Detroit on his lecture tour. We would like you to tape record his entire lecture and then transmit his lecture to us via your light beam equipment. Seemed like a strange request. We got hold of Williamson. Sure enough, he was coming back to Detroit and was scheduled to give a lecture on October the 17th. We told him what these people had requested. He got a little bit excited. So we went down on this night and we taped his lecture. And later on that evening, we had been instructed that at 9 o'clock, this happened to be a Sunday evening, at 9 o'clock in the evening, we were to transmit this tape to them via this light beam. And they said, all you have to do is point your unit roughly in the direction of the North Star. Fine. We set it up. And we aimed it roughly in the direction of the North Star. We were in a friend's living room who had a nice big picture window. And we had the tape recorder set up there. We aimed this thing up. We had a little sighting device on the top of this. And we aimed it about at the North Star. And we played the tape. Now came the receiving part of it, because they said that they would answer us back on this unit that we had constructed. We thought, this is going to be good. First of all, the opening to our unit was a piece of half-inch conduit, 5 inches long. That was the only way the light could get into that photocell, so that any light would have to come down that little 5-inch tube. It would be like trying to line up, you're trying to line up with a rifle barrel a half a mile away. And we figured this is going to be a neat trick for them, because they're going to have to be directly in line with our unit in order for us to get a thing, get anything. Well, we plugged in the receiving part of it, and all we got was one horrible loud hum on the tape recorder. We realized suddenly we had a problem in our receiver. We had lost a ground connection someplace, and we had a loud buzzing hum. No message could possibly come back. Well, we got out the soldering irons and the screwdrivers, and we dismantled the unit, checked it all the way through. 2 hours later, we found a poor solder connection, repaired it, got it working, plugged it in. Everything was fine. And we said, well, we've missed the boat. Our space friends had our schedule set up for 9 o'clock, and they were going to answer immediately. The minute we had sent them the tape. But we thought, what the heck? We did not line up the unit back with the North Star. We just aimed it out over the treetops out the picture window and said, well, fellas, if you can read our minds, you know where the thing's pointing. Here we are, 10-15 people crowded into this front room with the lights turned down low so there wouldn't be any reflections on the window glass, and so that this little unit could see if anything was out there. And within 5 minutes, the most astounding thing in the world happened. Pandemonium broke out in the front row. A UFO came down to treetop heights, jockeyed back and forth in position, lined itself up beautifully with our little unit, sat there, and then did the next most impossible thing electronically we could think of, modulated a glowing force field around the object at an audio rate, and sent us a message.